From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! It's the second week of our series of commentaries of death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Welcome to hell. A hell erected and maintained by human governments and blessed by black robe judges. A hell which allows you to see your loved ones, but not to touch them. A hell situated in America's boondocks, hundreds of miles away from most families. A white rural hell where most of the cage captives are black and urban. It is the American way of death.
Also, California environmentalist Judy Barry died this weekend of cancer. We play an interview with her recorded a year after the car she was driving was blown up.
I was also blamed for it. After the bomb went off, the police came in, and rather than, as I suspected, they would, well, I was unconscious at the time, but, rather than looking for a culprit among the people who had been ostentatiously threatening me and bringing about this reign of terror up in our rural areas, they said that Daryl and I were not only suspects in the bombing, but were the only suspects.
And this week, the New York City Council will consider cutting ties with companies doing business with Burma. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Albert Gore's fundraising efforts were criticized by a Democratic senator yesterday as another Democratic legislator charged that Gore's Republican predecessor had hosted a reception for GOP contributors at the vice president's residence. Senator Robert Torricelli, Democrat of New Jersey, referring to Gore's efforts, said, "I'm not going to be in the business of defending the undefendable." Torricelli was referring to a Washington Post story yesterday that quoted Democrats as describing Gore as their party's solicitor-in-chief in last year's campaign. Separately, former White House senior advisor George Stephanopoulos said on ABC's This Week that the Democratic National Committee had installed separate telephones, fax lines, and computers in government buildings to allow people there, including Gore, to work on political projects. Meanwhile, Democrats released copies of an invitation to a 1990 fundraising dinner hosted by former Vice President Quayle as they sought to deflect criticism of Gore's role in the party's push for campaign donations. Meanwhile, Democrats on Friday said they returned an additional $1.5 million in questionable contributions. The U.S. drug czar has defended President Clinton's decision Friday to recertify Mexico as an ally in the drug war, saying the move will help authorities fight corruption. Mexico has promised such a fight, but hours after the U.S. decision was announced, police there said a drug kingpin inexplicably escaped from their custody. Timothy McVeigh's lead attorney said he may seek a delay in the first Oklahoma City bombing trial following a newspaper report Friday that the suspect had confessed to his defense team that he carried out the 1995 attack that killed 168. He's to meet with the judge today on the March 31st starting date. Judy Barry, the fiery leader of the environmental group Earth First, who was injured in a 1990 car bomb blast, died yesterday of breast cancer. She was 47. We'll have more on that later in the show. Civil rights leader Benjamin Chavis denied that he was positioning himself to replace Louis Farrakhan by joining Farrakhan's Nation of Islam. "No, no, no. I am here to help Minister Farrakhan not to take over," said Chavis, who has changed his name to Chavis Muhammad. He said, "My only motive is to be dedicated to God and help Minister Farrakhan." Chavis Muhammad, who announced his conversion February 23rd, met yesterday with members of the Nation of Islam for more than 2 hours. He had planned to speak at the church where he was ordained a United Church of Christ minister in the 70s, but that appearance was canceled. The British government today confirmed that 16 people either had or were suspected of having the human version of mad cow disease. In its regular update on cases of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, the health department said there were 13 confirmed cases of the new variant of CJD and 3 suspected cases. This news about Peru: President Alberto Fujimori was due to head home early today from the Dominican Republic, where he discussed asylum for Peru's rebels holding 72 men hostage. The government and the rebels were to hold fresh talks in Lima later today, aimed at finding a bloodless solution to the 76-day-old crisis. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Today, we continue with our second week of airing commentaries by journalist and author Mumia Abu-Jamal, an inmate on Pennsylvania's death row. He's introduced by death penalty abolitionist sister Helen Prejean.
I am Sister Helen Prejean, author of Dead Man Walking. There are many parallels between slavery and the death penalty, the most salient being that African Americans are the primary victims of both. African Americans are sentenced to death and executed in numbers far greater than their proportion of the U.S. population. In my home state of Louisiana, for instance, the death row population is 62% black, which is double the percentage of African Americans in the overall population. Equally disturbing, a death sentence is most likely when the person killed is white, even though people of color are much more likely to be victims of murder.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African American. I live in the fastest growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. Imagine living, eating, sleeping, relieving oneself, daydreaming, weeping, but mostly waiting in the room the size of your bathroom. Now imagine doing all those things, but mostly waiting for the rest of your life. Imagine waiting, waiting, waiting to die. I don't have to imagine. I live in one of those rooms, like about 3,000 other men and women in 38 states across the United States. It's called death row. I call it hell. Welcome to hell. Each of the states which have death rows have a different system for their execution cases, varying from the relatively open to the severely restrictive. Some states, like California and Texas, allow their execution cases work, education, and/or religious service opportunities for out-of-cell time up to 8 hours a day. Pennsylvania locks its execution cases down 23 hours a day, 5 days a week, 24 hours the other 2 days. At the risk of quoting Mephistopheles, I repeat, welcome to hell. A hell erected and maintained by human governments and blessed by black-robed judges. A hell which allows you to see your loved ones, but not to touch them. A hell situated in America's boondocks, hundreds of miles away from most families. A white rural hell where most of the cage captives are black and urban. It is the American way of death. Contrary to what one might suppose, this hell is the easiest one to enter in a generally hellish criminal justice system. Why? Because unlike any other case, those deemed potential capital cases are severely restricted during the jury selection phase, as any juror who admits opposition to the death penalty is immediately and automatically removed, leaving only those who are fervent death penalty supporters in the pool of eligible jurors. When it is argued that to exclude those who oppose death and to include only those who supported death was fundamentally unfair, as the latter were more conviction prone, the United States Supreme Court, in a case titled Lockhart versus McCree, said such a claim was of no constitutional significance. Once upon a time, politicians promised jobs and benefits to constituents, like a chicken in every pot to get elected. It was a surefire vote getter. No longer. Today, the lowest level politico up to the president use another surefire gimmick to guarantee victory. Death. Promise death, and the election is yours. Guaranteed. Vraiment. A vote for hell in the land of liberty, with its over 1 million prisoners, is the ticket to victory. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
At Temple University, at least hundreds of phone calls, faxes, and letters have poured in to the university's administrative offices, protesting the cancellation of Democracy Now! And urging the university to put the show back on the air. Again, Temple University canceled the show last Monday, just as we were about to air the first of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The phone calls have been echoed by many free speech groups and press associations, including the ACLU, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, PEN America Center, and the Society of Professional Journalists. The Philadelphia Daily News also condemned the move, and there's a piece today in the New York Times on Temple University's decision to pull Democracy Now! Because of the Mumia Abu-Jamal commentaries. Today in Philadelphia, area residents are holding a demonstration in front of the Temple president's office condemning the censorship and demanding that Democracy Now! Be restored to the airwaves. Tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll bring you many of those voices at the demonstration. But right now, we turn to Pacifica's Don Rush, who did a piece on the controversy for the Pacifica Network News.
The host of Pacifica's Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman.
Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, yesterday unilaterally canceled Democracy Now! And pulled all Pacifica programming, including
with
the
those
Pacifica
words,
Network
Pacifica's
News
Democracy Now! Found itself this
RTI.
Week with around a dozen fewer outlets in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The outlets carry the programming of public radio station WRTI in Philadelphia. WRTI is owned and operated by Temple University. The school's public relations man, George Ingram, said the decision to pull Pacifica had been in the works for some time due to programming changes. But during an interview with WPKN's news director, Vincent Kay, Ingram admitted that the commentaries by prison inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal were the final straw. Abu-Jamal was convicted in 1982 of killing a Philadelphia police officer and now sits on death row.
When I learned that Pacifica was going to air the Mumia Abu-Jamal commentaries, that really hastened my decision. And basically, I know that NPR in 1994 refused to run these run the commentaries. They said they had severe misgivings about it and felt they were inappropriate. And frankly, what was good enough for NPR was good enough for me.
Indeed, in 1994, National Public Radio did consider airing the commentaries, but pulled back just hours before broadcast after an outcry by law enforcement organizations. Julie Drizin, Democracy Now!'s executive producer, does not find the NPR precedent compelling.
I think that it takes a tremendous amount of courage to go against the grain and bring unpopular dissident voices to the air. It's something that Pacifica has always done and will continue to do because we don't believe there can be any compromise on First Amendment issues.
But George Ingram with Temple University indicated to Vincent Kay that it wasn't just the commentaries.
Pacifica Radio has done a great job of broadcasting and using this as a propaganda machine. We're going to move forward with what we feel is the right direction for the radio station to take.
But Pacifica's Julie Drizin says Democracy Now! Does not take a position on Abu-Jamal's guilt or innocence. She says the show has tried to get an official from the university, someone from the police union, and even the widow of the slain officer to come on the show. But she says all turned down the invitation.
We have tried to open this up as a discussion and a debate, which I think is really healthy for democracy. Instead, what Temple University and the Fraternal Order of Police have tried to do, and the state of Pennsylvania has tried to do, is shut off debate, and I think that's very unhealthy for democracy.
Reaction from listeners produced hundreds of telephone calls to Democracy Now!'s listener comment line.
And I just want to thank you so much for your courage, and I want to give you support and congratulations. It's a wonderful thing, and takes a lot of guts, and you got the guts.
Having a police officer murdered by an individual does not qualify them as a legitimate individual to voice their opinion. Hopefully, in the future, you'll use better judgment.
So what are these mysterious commentaries like? Here's a portion of one on the death penalty.
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. That's what capital punishment really means. Those that ain't got the capital gets the punishment, is the old saying. Once again, we see the inherent truths that lie in the proverbs of the poor. That old saying echoed when it was announced that the District Attorney of Delaware County, Patrick Meehan, would not seek the death penalty in the case of John E. DuPont, the wealthy corporate heir charged with the shooting death of Olympic champion David Schultz. The Delaware County DA's office said no aggravated circumstances justifying the death sentence existed. Could it be that DuPont's personal wealth, estimated at over $400 million, was a factor? In one fell swoop, the state ensured that while millionaires may be murderers, they are not eligible for that preserve of the poor, America's death row.
Before the 1982 murder conviction, Abu Jamal had been a part-time radio reporter who had come out of the Black Panther movement. But now he sits on death row, and some question the validity of a network allowing him to broadcast commentaries. Larry Grossman, former president of PBS and NBC News.
There's a big difference between having a news person interview somebody who is newsworthy and having somebody who is a convicted criminal or who's committed some horrible offense be given a free platform to spout his own views without the intermediary of a journalist or a news person.
But others disagree. The Society of Professional Journalists denounced the sudden decision to drop Pacifica programming over the commentaries. And G. Kelly Hawes, past president of the Society, says he wouldn't have a problem with airing the pieces by inmates.
Commentary is someone's opinion, and you can air that opinion and people can react to that opinion. So I don't have a problem with airing a commentary by practically anyone. I mean, as a First Amendment advocate, I believe we all have freedom of speech, and we all also have the opportunity to respond to someone else's speech.
Indeed, the Society says there's a disturbing pattern of shutting out voices from the nation's prisons. At least seven states, it says, have restricted media access, including Pennsylvania and California. Laura Flanders, with the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, says the case of Abu Jamal highlights the problem for authorities.
What they have a problem with is people around Pennsylvania being able to hear the voice of a human on death row who talks about human concerns. And I think that that's where radio in particular is being targeted. It's because it does have the power to humanize and bring an individual into your own life, into your own room as a listener. And that's what is beyond the pale for the Fraternal Order of Police and also apparently for Temple University.
Don Rush, Pacifica Network News, Washington.
Thanks for that report, Don. And if you'd like to weigh in about how you feel about Temple University taking Democracy Now! Off the airwaves because of the airing of the commentaries of Mumia Abu-Jamal, you can call the Temple University president. You can call 215-204-7405. That's 215-204-7405. Temple University president Peter Liakouris's email address is pjl@eop.temple.edu. That's pjl@eop.temple.edu. The spoken word. It's on a CD called Beautiful World in Existence. Judy Barry, environmentalist, wobbly, mother and friend, died yesterday morning in her home in Willits in Northern California, about 140 miles north of San Francisco, the heart of Redwood Country. She led the environmental group Earth First in the late 1980s, turning the group into a potent national force. She also organized the first Redwood Summer, a mass civil disobedience action in 1990 to save California's old-growth redwoods. In the process, Earth First and Judy Barry suffered widespread repression. In 1990, the car in which she was driving with Daryl Cherney on the way to an organizing meeting in Oakland was bombed, injuring both passengers. Oakland police, with the backing of the FBI, arrested her and Daryl Cherney for allegedly setting the pipe bomb that blew up their car. In just a minute, we're going to go to an interview that KPFA producer Dennis Bernstein did with Judy in the spring of 1991, a year after the bombing. But just before we do that and before our break, Dennis, welcome to Democracy Now!, having come across the country to speak at the Burma hearings tomorrow. We're going to talk about that later in the show. But just give us a, can you just tell us a little about Judy?
Judy Barry was clearly one of the few revolutionaries still left and active in this country. She was an itinerant, wobbly union organizer, a fantastic campsite fiddler. And unrelenting voice for the people. She was the activist that led Earth First to a national, for people to know it nationally. And she really ran smack into a violent wall when she took on Charles Hurwitz, the banking bandit who gutted a Texas SNL for $1 billion, was sued by the FDIC, and then came to California, took over Pacific Lumber, gutted the pension funds of the organization, and started mowing down old growth redwoods. And she stood eye to eye with this deadly corporate giant.
Dennis, we have to break to go to the interview you did with her a number of years ago. Can you just set the scene?
We spoke right after a rally for the against the war in Iraq, and Judy had given a fiery speech. It was very noisy. There was music outside. She had just put down her fiddle. We got into my car, of all places, and began to talk about all the research she had done in the last year about how the FBI was either the bomber or protecting the bomber.
Well, we're going to go to that interview you did in just a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we move now to that interview that Dennis Bernstein of Pacifica's KPFA did with Judy Barry. Judy Barry, who died just yesterday in Willits, Northern California, died of cancer. Leader of the environmental group Earth First in the late 1980s. Her car was blown up in 1990, and just a year after that explosion, Dennis got her, Judy Barry, in his car, and they had a conversation about her life.
This is Dennis Bernstein. I am sitting in a car, of all places, with Judy Barry. And almost a year to the day, Judy, well, it's coming up the anniversary of the bombing in which you and Daryl Cherney almost lost your lives. And I want to start there by asking you, first of all, how you're feeling or have you recovered yet?
Well, I haven't recovered yet, and I never will recover. I received permanent injuries from it. I've gotten farther than anyone expected me to. I was not expected to walk, and I can walk short distances without assistance. It's hard to sit. It's you know, I have low endurance. I'm not up to what I used to be, but I'm living back where I was, back in the Redwood region, and I'm still in the movement, and I'm as much as I can by my energy levels, I'm still active.
All right, let me ask you. First, for people who don't understand what happened, could you describe exactly what happened and who you think might be responsible?
Okay, well, immediately preceding this bombing, I need to put it in a little bit of context. We have a real crisis in the Redwoods in that a few giant corporations, are cutting them down as fast as they can, and they're almost gone. 95% have been cut. And we feel we have a crisis to stop them, an ecological crisis and an economic crisis, because as they finish cutting, they leave our already poor rural communities decimated with people, just like the Rust Belt or the Dust Bowl. People have nothing else to do for a living. So in this context, Earth First came on the scene several years ago and began to use direct action, innovative kind of tactics to fight the corporations and bring attention to the cutting of the redwoods. For example, we will climb a old growth redwood tree and set up a platform 100 feet up in the air and have somebody sit in that platform to prevent the tree from being cut. So that kind of theatrical demonstration to bring attention to, that was the method by which we were working. But the more effective that we got, the more forceful they seemed to get on the other side. And things seemed to be reaching a fever pitch here. There was an initiative coming up in the fall, that, as of last summer, 1990, there was to be an initiative where the voters would get to vote on reforming logging rules to make them slow down. And because of this, the timber companies had decided they were going to take out every tree they could as fast as they could last summer to beat the regulations. And when they announced this, we announced that we were sponsoring a campaign called Redwood Summer, and that basing our actions on that, we also called it Mississippi Summer in the California Redwoods, and we modeled it on the Freedom Summers of Mississippi. We said we needed freedom riders for the forest to come and engage in nonviolent actions and try to slow this cut down. And we appealed to people all over the country in order to get the word out, and also because along with the level of cutting, the level of violence against demonstrators was rising in our area. A woman had been punched and had her nose broken. One of our organizers had been knocked out at a demonstration. And I and my children had been run off the road by a logging truck on the way to a demonstration and sent to the hospital by it. And there were many other incidences like this. So we felt that in order to be able to continue to demonstrate, the local police were turning their backs on the situation. And we needed to have the eyes of the nation on us. We didn't think that people would approve either of the slaughtering of redwoods or the slaughtering of demonstrators. So we put out a national call for action. And when we did it, tensions rose even more. And I began to receive a series of death threats that were increasingly frightening. The most scary one was a photo of me from the newspaper with a rifle scope and crosshairs superimposed over my face and a yellow ribbon, which is the symbol of the timber industry, stapled to it. And it became really clear that I and other organizers were being specifically targeted and they were attempting to terrorize us. But we continued, and we didn't back down, and we continued to put out this call. And as we went out, Daryl Cherney, myself, and some other Earth Firsters, we began a tour of the California colleges to do a little show to get students to come to Redwood Summer. And on the way to one of those shows, my car blew up with me in it, and I was nearly killed by a pipe bomb that was placed under my seat. And, you know, it went off without warning. It was hidden way under my seat, so I couldn't possibly have seen it or anything. But in addition to being literally nearly killed by it, I was also blamed for it. After the bomb went off, the police came in, and rather than, as I suspected they would, well, I was unconscious at the time, but you know, rather than looking for a culprit among the people who had been ostentatiously threatening me and bringing about this reign of terror up in our rural areas, they said that Daryl and I were not only suspects in the bombing, but were the only suspects. And the FBI destroyed evidence. They cut my car apart. They sent pieces of it to Washington, D.C., supposedly to their crime lab. But what they actually did was destroyed the car so you couldn't see where the bomb had been placed. Then they left the rest of the car out in the rain, which would get rid of any remaining residue. So the FBI actually conspired to prevent any really knowledge of how this bomb went off. And their entire investigation was focused on me and Daryl. They just said that we were the bombers. And there was even a note received by a local newspaper claiming credit for the bombing from someone calling himself the Lord's Avenger, saying that God told him to kill me. And he described the bomb, this letter writer, in such detail that the FBI had to admit that the person who wrote this letter must have been the bomber. But rather than looking for the bomber among obvious suspects in my community, the FBI and the Oakland police said, well, since I must be the bomber, this letter must have been written by an accomplice of mine. And their investigation of the letter consisted of raiding my house yet another time and also raiding the house of my ex-husband, looking for matching typewriters, which of course they didn't find. So this went on for, I think, 8 weeks. They continued to blame us, even though they had no evidence whatsoever. And the press continued cooperating with the FBI, printing every FBI lie as the truth and not printing what was really going on. And it went on for 8 weeks, and we were tried and convicted in the press, and we were presented as bombers. But at the end of 8 weeks, there was no evidence against us, and charges were dropped.
Daryl was in jail most of this time.
Daryl was only in jail for a short time. He was arrested immediately following the bombing, in shock from the bombing, still with injuries, although his injuries were much slighter than mine. I was also arrested while I was in the hospital, unconscious. I was taken to the jail ward, from the critical care unit. They took me to the jail ward and had, so they treated us both pretty atrociously. But Daryl made bail. They put up bail for Daryl, and he immediately made it. I think the original bail was like $10,000. He immediately made bail, so they raised it to $100,000. And we made the bail again, and so Daryl was, although charged and arrested, not kept in jail.
Now, do you have any indication about who might have been responsible?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know who placed the bomb in my car, and one of the reasons I don't know is because the FBI, the Oakland police, and my local county police actively blocked any real investigation, and the trail's cold now. There are several suspects. Some of the local contract loggers made very overt threats to me, and we've since found out were paying people to lay in wait for us in the woods, armed vigilantes waiting for us with instructions to shoot. Those people are certainly suspects. There's also a very virulent anti-abortion movement in my area, and I once led a clinic defense against the when they tried to shut down a clinic that was opening in Ukiah, which was my hometown. And the Lord's Avenger letter that claimed responsibility for the bombing referred to this demonstration in great detail and cited it as one of the reasons he wanted to kill me. I know virtually everyone who was at that demonstration, and some of those people are certainly suspects. But still, I don't know who placed the bomb in my car. I know that the timber industry, the police, and the local vigilantes pretty openly conspired to set up a situation where I was bound to be attacked.
Well, the trail may be cold, but the heat is still around you, Judy Berry. You were recently, during the war, you were heading down to give a speech in Santa Barbara, and some interesting things happened. Could you describe what happened there?
Yeah, I was scheduled to speak in Santa Barbara. It was really my first out-of-town speaking gig. Traveling is very difficult for me. And a few days before I was supposed to be there at University of California, Santa Barbara, there began to be pipe bombs on campus. Now, it was a pipe bomb, of course, that was in my car. And the pipe bombs, there were three that were found. None exploded, but three armed pipe bombs were disarmed on campus. One of them was in the campus library, where students were present. And what they claimed was that these pipe bombs were from a left-wing group, they said, calling itself Rights of Spring. And but this Rights of Spring group was simultaneously threatening organizers of the event I was to speak at. And there's no history of left activity in Santa Barbara, although there's quite a history of right-wing organized activity. So I never really thought that these bombs were legitimately an extreme left group. They were certainly discrediting to the anti-war and the environmental movement. When I went down there, nothing happened. I was scared to go down, but I went anyway. And nothing happened, and there was no incidents with the bombs while I was there. But immediately after I left, 12 activists, including all of the Earth Firsters in the area who had organized the conference that I spoke at, were approached by the FBI for questioning. They tried to get them separately. Some of them, the less sophisticated, let the FBI talk to them, of course, without warrants. And the FBI asked them such questions as, do you know anyone more radical than yourself? And so they basically harassed and pursued people who had organized the event at which I spoke. I had thought that these bombs had nothing to do with me and it was just a coincidence. But later, someone from the Oakland police told a reporter, in order for the word to get back to me, that, oh, yes, we know that Judy spoke in Santa Barbara and that these bombs were going off from this group called Rights of Spring. And the reporter expressed a little surprise that and said, yes, that I had been afraid to go down there. And the police responded, oh, yeah, we thought we just presumed those were Earth First bombs. So now I'm not so sure that those bombs had nothing to do with me being there. I'm certain that it was sabotage of the movement. Whether it was related to trying to discredit me, I'm not sure, but they sure seemed to take every opportunity.
I can tell you that I did some investigation of that myself, and I know this, the FBI did not investigate any right-wing groups on that campus. Judy Berry, I want to stay with the same general topic, which has to do with a recent article that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner accusing Earth First essentially of not caring about human beings and, in fact, hatching a plot to kill humans and save the Earth. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about that and what you think about what's happening there.
Well, this was a preposterous article. I mean, here we have this press that won't cover anything that we're really doing. But on the front page of the Sunday paper in San Francisco, they put this article that said something like, plot to rid Earth of humans. And they said that according to an ex-CIA agent named Canestrara, they said that Earth First has clandestine cells of scientists up in the hills trying to develop a virus to kill humans only and leave the rest of the life forms intact. And this man offered no proof whatsoever of this, not a shred of proof, not a detail to be offered, but just his word as an ex-CIA agent. This was printed as fact. The author of the article then says, well, the Earth First Journal is a rich repository. That's our national newsletter. The Earth First Journal is a rich repository of such thinking. And as an example, the best example he could come up with, he cited an anonymous letter to the editor in 1984. And that's a pretty amazing best scenario for proof that we did it. Of course, we had nothing to do with this. This is ridiculous. And it's ridiculous in that it's laughable. It sounds like the National Enquirer. It doesn't sound credible at all. But it is very dangerous to us up in these rural areas because people, first of all, are not as sophisticated as they are in the cities and are more easily led to believe such things. But what an article like this does is it tends to marginalize us and discredit us, and it makes it easier for them to whip up hate campaigns against us if we're considered to be so evil and so unhuman ourselves that we would like to wipe out all of humankind. What we're actually trying to do is deal with the fact that the society that we're living in is destroying the Earth, and we think that we need to live a different way. We need to live in a manner that does not destroy the Earth. That, of course, threatens the corporation's power, and that's why they're out to discredit us. So I was really concerned about this CIA article because it appeared at the same time as a kind of local hate campaign was being revved up, similar to what happened last year before the bombing. When wild claims of our supposed violence, false press releases claiming to be from us but not actually from us at all, with no contact names or with our names spelled wrong, were being circulated in the sawmills and in the logging towns. And these releases were claiming that Earth Firsters are going to use violence this summer and attack the loggers. They use this to stir the loggers up to attack us. The same with the CIA article. This came in the heat of a similar campaign coming up. At the Redwood Region Logging Show about a month ago, a professional forester, gave the keynote speech, and he openly called for a hate campaign against environmentalists. He said, we've tried the love us tactic, and it didn't work. Now we're going to try hate them. He called us watermelons. He said, we're green on the outside and red on the inside. And he said, we're tired of turning the other cheek. It's time to kick these people in the crotch. And one of the Board of Supervisors, that's the governing agency of Humboldt County, one of the counties up here, just last week said, because there's the layoffs, actually, there's quite a few layoffs. We have economic devastation going on, but it's not related to any environmental laws. It's related to their cut-and-run policies. But this man threatened that if any environmental laws were passed, this is a government official, he said, if people keep taking food out of other people's mouths, somebody's going to get killed. And he explained very carefully, he was referring to the environmentalists in that statement, and he repeatedly called us terrorists. And what happens is basically there's official endorsement going on to this hate campaign. And when this is coupled with these news leaks, quote unquote, from ex-CIA agents, this man, the ex-CIA agent who made these claims, ridiculous claims about us trying to develop a virus to wipe out humans, this is a man who was involved in the Iran-Contra scandal and was an operative with Casey. I don't think there is any such thing as an ex-CIA agent. But at any rate, he's certainly still involved in trying to discredit what's really a legitimate and effective political group.
Judy Berry, you have been an environmentalist and a union organizer for some time. You have just witnessed a massive military action in the Middle East by the United States government. You've heard some talk about the New World Order. I would like you to sort of respond to this. You know, what are you thinking in terms of the war and the New World Order at home? What are your thoughts, what are your fears, and what are your hopes?
Well, of course, the new World Order is, of course, the old world order. You know, it involves the rule of privilege. It involves the destruction of both the people and of the earth. For the advantage of a few very large, very powerful corporations that are international in scale, that are not ruled by our government, that rule our government, in fact. George Bush is certainly one of these people. His own corporate connections connect him to, for example, Zapata Oil Company, of which he was the chief CEO earlier. And this is a company that was doing offshore oil drilling in Kuwait. And he was also on the board of directors of a company, a construction company that received a contract to rebuild Panama. So I think that there's a really strong rule by the corporations, and it's not a rule of law, and it's not a rule of democracy. democracy. It's a rule of intimidation and terrorism, and this kind of jackboot patriotism that I see going on, waving yellow ribbons. The yellow ribbons were up here, the sign of the reactionary timber forces, the ones who wanted to cut every tree, lay everyone off, and shoot anybody who would object to them. And that's what's going on. Now I've seen this campaign. It was a polarizing campaign, this yellow ribbon campaign. I watched yellow ribbons come into towns and polarize them, and now I've seen it go nationwide. And they've used the same tactics, the tactics of intimidation, the tactics of trying to, of misrepresenting who the peace activists or who the environmentalists, misrepresenting who we are and what our intentions are, of using brute force, really, of using intimidation to get us to shut up and to embolden the right. And what I see happening is people being afraid and not speaking out. I think that it's really important at this point that we not back down, because I fear that really what we're facing, for the first time, I can understand what happened in Nazi Germany. I could never understand how a whole population could be so brainwashed, but I'm seeing the same kind of tendencies here, and I think it's very frightening. I think it's real important for people with any progressive views and with any principles to have some courage to stand up to this and to stand up together and not allow groups like Earth First, not allow groups in the peace movement to be marginalized by these forces.
Judy Barry, interviewed by Pacifica producer Dennis Bernstein in the spring of 1991. It was just a year after she was driving her car and it was blown up. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back just for a minute to talk a bit more about Judy Barry, who died yesterday of cancer in California. And then we're going to turn to an issue that's happening this week in New York, and that is an attempt of a number of activists to end the city's contracts with any companies that do business in Burma. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman, and before we move on to our next subject, Dennis, thanks so much for sharing that interview with us from 6 years ago. I know that just on Friday, 2 days before Judy died in her home in Willits, California, her case once again went to court.
She's suing the FBI for false arrest because she was arrested as the bomber of herself, and they had such disdain. She is in major discovery. They've delayed for 5 years. In the last time that she could come and take depositions in which she personally questioned the FBI, they accused her of faking her cancer. Well, obviously, they were wrong about that.
Maybe they'll deny that she's died.
You never know, but she hasn't.
Well, Dennis, thanks very much again for bringing us that interview. But I should say, you're here in New York. You've come across country because you and a number of other people are going to be testifying before the New York City Council tomorrow around the issue of Burma. In recent weeks, Burma's military leadership has launched attacks on the only remaining ethnic group that's resisted the dictatorship, the Karens, and their organization, the Karen National Union. Thousands have fled their homes and villages, fleeing toward neighboring Thailand. Groups ranging from Amnesty International to the U.S. Refugee Committee have condemned the offensive by Burma's State Law and Order Restoration Council, known as SLORC. And in New York, Burmese democracy activists are taking their fight to the New York City Council. The government in exile wants the largest city in the United States to cut all ties with companies doing business in Burma. And here to discuss these developments are two people. Dennis will continue to join us. Dennis Bernstein is a journalist and a producer of the daily news magazine Flashpoints on Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. And Dennis co-authored the article, People of the Opiate, Burma's Dictatorship of Drugs Touches Everything, Even the CIA. It was a cover story of the December 16th issue of The Nation magazine. We're also joined by Dr. Tang Chong, the UN representative of the National Coalition Government of the Union of Burma. And we welcome you both. Why don't we begin with Dr. Chun? Can you tell us about these city council hearings? First of all, if New York City Council were to pass a resolution that would end doing business with all companies doing business in Burma, it wouldn't be the first time in this country.
Yeah, it is the second hearing. There's selective purchasing law, which is the South African-style economic sanction bill for Burma, was introduced last year. After that, we had a hearing in February last year. And then the issue is pending, waiting for the list of contracts city made. And then it is the second time, and we are pushing the city council to organize this hearing because of the deteriorating situation inside the country.
What are the other cities where legislation has been passed, like the one you're calling for in New York?
So in the United States, nine cities, as well as Massachusetts state, already passed selective purchasing law on Burma.
So Massachusetts, let's see, San Francisco.
And then Santa Monica, Oakland, and what is San Wisconsin, and
Madison.
Seattle already passed the selective purchasing law legislation.
So we'll see what happens here in New York. What will you be saying? What will your testimony be, Dr. Chun?
Yeah, I will mainly testify to point the fact that, you know, military regime is able to reconcile with the drug traffickers, and at the same time, you know, they treated the elected MPs of the 1990 election as criminals. So the point I would like to stress at the hearing is that, you know, the situation is getting worse. Military is stepping up a suppressive campaign against the elected MPs of the National League for Democracy, and they impose restriction on Aung San Suu Kyi, and Aung San Suu Kyi, who is the leader of the Burmese democracy movement and Nobel laureates, is now under death threat, and she is virtually under house arrest since May. So the situation inside the country is getting worse. At the same time, military is launching very severe offensive to the Karen minorities at the Thai-Burma border. And in connection with this offensive, you know, now there are problems of refugees, and Thailand is forcing the refugees back to the Burma. It is the horrible situation. So that we need to put more pressure on the military regime. And we strongly believe that any sort of economic sanction is the effective instrument, you know, to bring about change in our country.
Dennis Bernstein, what companies would this affect?
Well, the key company in the United States is Unocal, the huge oil giant in Los Angeles. And Dr. Tung is right that there is a particular urgency now because the military action being carried out by the SLORC at the border is right around the billion-dollar pipeline that Unocal is building with the French company Total. So the SLORC, the dictatorship, is in there burning towns, taking thousands of people, forcing them into forced labor, children, giving them guns, forcing them to fight battles, to clear out the region for U.S. corporations to do business in Burma.
What about the border? What is behind these current battles on the border with Thailand?
Well, as I said, the Karens, the final resistance group of the many ethnic groups in Burma that have actively resist the SLORC, have their headquarters around Unocal at the Thai border. So there are several reasons. That's the corporate side of it. Then there's the drug side of it. This is the first time since World War II that the central Burmese government has control of all the borders. And they have chosen to bolster their hold on power with the narco dollar. The urgency here is if they can bolster themselves with the narco dollar, they can build a gap that will allow them to expand the drug trade and also do business with Unocal and Total. Now understand, now this is so significant. The Myanmar Oil and Gas Enterprise, that's MOGE, that's the national oil company of Burma.
That's what SLORC renamed Burma,
that's
Myanmar.
And that is the state-controlled oil company. They cut the deal with Unocal and Total. MOGE is the key money laundering structure for the Burmese hunter. And we're talking about a situation of 50% of the world's heroin is now coming out of Burma. 60% of the heroin that comes into the United States comes from Burma. The amount of heroin coming into Burmese heroin coming into New York City has tripled since 1989, since the SLORC has taken power. So you've got a situation where the SLORC is using U.S. corporations like Unocal as a front for money laundering. Unocal pays the Moj $15 million, but meanwhile, they're processing hundreds of millions of dollars through these accounts that are held in Singapore and Burma, and nobody knows where the money comes. Of course, it's coming from drugs.
Now, just in the last few days, President Clinton has once again decertified Colombia because of saying that it is not doing enough in the cooperation against the war on drugs, although it has certified Mexico. What about Burma?
Well, this is a major battle going on now. In November of last year, Clinton was in Thailand and in Bangkok at a university congratulating the Thai government for helping to fight Burma and the drug trade. Meanwhile, he could have been close to the largest money laundering operation for Burma in the world, which is in Bangkok, Thailand now. Clinton has had strong words. Madeleine Albright has had strong words in terms of restraining the Burmese government, but they're not holding Unocal back. In fact, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce behind the scenes is urging U.S. corporations to beat the French to invest in Burma. So what you've got a schizophrenic policy where Clinton is saying, we've got to fight this drug trade, and they're giving the green flag to Unocal.
You know, it's interesting. Just in these last few days, you mentioned, Dr. Chen, the Massachusetts state legislature passing a law that would stop Massachusetts from doing business with any company doing business in Burma. Just a few days ago, José Ramos Horta, the 1996 Nobel Peace Prize winner, went up to Massachusetts and testified along with other people, other Timorese, to try to pass the same law around Indonesia.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting here is that apparently behind the scenes, because of the law passed on Burma and the impending one on Indonesia, the State Department and the U.S. Trade Representative is working behind the scenes to put pressure on Massachusetts, because these kind of democratic actions where states decide who they want to do business with are apparently GATT illegal. Is that right? GATT illegal because they are imposing an obstacle to trade.
Yes, there is a... we heard about the complaints made by the European
Union,
Union and also Japan to the Massachusetts bill, pointing out that it is against the WTO legislation or like that.
Right, the World Trade Organization.
In my view, that I believe that the people of Massachusetts state has the right to make their own decision to whom they are going to make business and to whom they are not going to make business. You know, it is the sovereign rights of the people of Massachusetts.
This is an issue that Ralph Nader raised repeatedly when he was opposing GATT, saying that this will strip us of our democratic rights to make decisions like these. But still, President Clinton signed off.
And Suharto, by the way, is on his way for a big meeting with the SLORC, the first time in decades. He's going to be visiting Burma, and they're going to have a major meeting and discuss trade policies and a new relationship between Indonesia and the SLORC.
Suharto, reigning dictator in Indonesia.
Correct. And the other side of this story, which is a real travesty, is to follow what I'm calling the AIDS heroin pipeline. And if you follow the AIDS heroin pipeline out of Burma and in a strange, circuitous route into the United States, you will see an unbelievable horror epidemic of heroin and AIDS. In Burma, you have a situation where now state-controlled mines are paying workers in heroin. There are shooting galleries around Burma where hundreds of people share a single needle. You've got a situation where there's a heroin epidemic among students who can't do political activity, but they have no problem getting heroin. You follow it out into China. A new AIDS epidemic over the border in China. In India, it's a terrible situation. Through Nigeria, a major heroin epidemic because you got the Nigerian generals as the middlemen now for Burmese heroin. You follow that into New York City and you see where 50% of IV drug users are HIV positive. Many of them are using this new, more potent heroin. So this is a situation that has implications globally and here in the United States.
What is happening right now with Aung San Suu Kyi, Dr. Chen?
She's virtually under house arrest since May. You know, previously she could have meeting with the people every weekend. Since May, you know, the weekend rallies in front of her home was forbidden, and after that, she is under death threat since one of the minister of the State Law and Order Restoration Council told the members of the Union Solidarity and Development Association that she should be killed. So it is a very dangerous situation for Aung San Suu Kyi.
We are watching as one state or city after another passes these laws that would forbid the state or the city from doing business with companies that do business with Burma. What about the U.S. Congress?
Yes, U.S. Congress already passed a legislation which calls for the conditional sanction. That is called Cohen-Feinstein Bill. Cohen-Feinstein Bill gave the authority to the president to impose sanction on Burma if military rearrest Suu Kyi, or if military force Suu Kyi to be in exile, or if there is large-scale suppression against the Burmese democracy movement. Now we want to say that the situation in the country has already met the conditions set in the Cohen-Feinstein Bill. You know, the military regime arrested a number of NLD members, a number of NLD MPs, and also students, since May. So at the same time, they are launching offensive to the current minorities at the border, and it caused refugees problem at the Thai-Burma border. So the situation has already met, and president should impose the sanction as soon as possible.
The problem is extreme, Amy. What happened is the SLORC first went over the border into Thailand with the help of the Thai government standing by and watching this happen, purged the people, sent them running toward the border of Burma, hammer and anvil, and while the Burmese military raids the Karen camps, burns the Karen town, so you got people running in both directions. It's a real scene there. Meanwhile, in this country, there's another legal action being taken by the oil, chemical, and atomic workers. This is a shareholders resolution against Unocal for participating in this major drug money laundering, sort of providing the front for Burma to launder drug money. So you've got the chemical workers suing Unocal in California, even as these other legal actions are being taken around the country.
Do you think President Clinton will impose sanctions?
I do not know. I hope he does, but I rather suspect he won't.
And Unocal, what has been Unocal's response?
Unocal says it's not illegal for them to do this kind of investment. The United States government has not prevented them. There is no U.S. law to prevent them from doing this. So they're begging to be restrained.
Unocal always argued that they are not involved in politics. They are just interested in business. But we want to say that any communists cannot do business in Burma without directly or indirectly support the Burmese military regime.
That's right. They control everything. They micromanage every detail of what goes on there. And they even have now state banks in Burma offering discounts for essentially drug money.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Dr. Tung Chun, the UN representative of the National Coalition of the Government of the Union of Burma in exile here in the United States. He'll be testifying tomorrow, as will Dennis Bernstein, journalist and producer at KPFA, Pacifica Station in Berkeley. And you can check out his piece. I bet it's on The Nation's website, thenation.com. Is it thenation.com or .org? Well, we'll see. Anyway, check it out. Look for The Nation. Put it into your search engine. And it's called People of the Opiate: Burma's Dictatorship of Drugs Touches Everything, Even the Central Intelligence Agency. Thanks so much for being with us, and we'll update our listeners on what happens as a result of these hearings in the New York City Council. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Our engineer is Errol Maitland. Our executive producer is Julie Drizin. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We also would like to send our condolences to the family of Judy Barry, who is a dear friend to many in the Pacifica Network, fiery activist and environmentalist again, who died yesterday at her home in North Carolina. In Northern California. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks very much for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!